This is the McKinsey Podcast, where we help you make sense out of our world's toughest business challenges.
Welcome to the show. I'm Lucia Riley.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
We know that you're significantly more likely to live in a food desert. That is a USDA designated census tract that does not have what is deemed to be adequate access to fresh food if you are Black. And we spent a bunch of time surveying thousands of Black consumers, and their preferences for healthy, organic actually show up as stronger preferences than other communities, just on average.
That's McKinsey senior partner Shelley Stewart III. He joins me to talk about investment opportunities like in health equity to support Black economic mobility.
After artificial intelligence, we'll hear from Asif Somek, CEO and co-founder of Aguazio. His company is a leader in AI and machine learning technology and was recently acquired by McKinsey. He offers solutions for addressing pilot fatigue.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks for joining the podcast today.
Thank you, Roberta, for having me. Very happy to be here.
Black economic mobility is why we're here today. Our recent report identified 8 areas with the best potential to improve it while also offering investors favorable market returns. Shelley, you and I discussed that for today, we're going to focus on 3 opportunities in particular: financial inclusion, health equity, and the digital divide. But before we get into all that, would you say that now is a particularly opportune time to reach investors?
I think that's absolutely right. Frankly, what happened to the Black community and other underserved communities during the pandemic, as well as some of the social justice movements in the wake of the murder of George Floyd and countless others, really brought this conversation of economic mobility into sharper focus for folks who may not have been spending as much time thinking about it. And so you see that idea proliferating throughout the economy, throughout sectors. You see it in the public sector and the social sector, and then, of course, in the private sector, including the investment community.
I wanted to focus in first on financial inclusion. There is an 8x wealth gap between Black Americans and white Americans. What are the key obstacles here? What are the reasons for this disparity?
Sometimes people assume that the lack of involvement in the financial services sector is just a symptom of a lack of resourcing in the Black community. And it's important to understand it both as a symptom and as a cause. And many of the traditional barriers to Black Americans involving in the banking sector include historical distrust as a function of interactions over time that either being excluded or interactions that have been less than positive. There's another point around just access, particularly in a kind of analog and brick and mortar world. There's this notion of banking deserts and not being proximate to actual branch banking. And so that creates just an actual, physical hurdle around convenience and access. And the other thing I would just cite is the products and the offering. By virtue of having smaller incomes and lower or no starting wealth, some of the products are just cumbersome and frankly, not appropriate with the form factor today. And so it's just not working for swaths of the population. And that means that people are not participating in saving. They're not able to access their checks in ways that are low cost. You get a direct deposit and you take your money out of your bank. You don't have to go to a check cashing place that might take a larger percentage of that in order to kind of help you or bridge through some sort of a payday loan, et cetera. And so that creates challenges. And I believe that's where the private markets come into play.
So to that point then, Shelley, what can investors do? Where can folks put funding and resources in a way that's going to make the greatest impact?
As I framed up some of the challenges, I think the other side of that coin is, what are the opportunities? Let me give a few thoughts against the 3 things that I framed up. The first is this point about trust. Well, the lack of trust in existing institutions creates a clear opportunity for new entrants, non-incumbents, to enter into the arena and develop a compelling value proposition and loyalty. The second thing is this point around access. There's the brick and mortar point that I made, but as we think more about the role of digital, and I know we'll come back to the broadband topic a bit later, but if we think about this role of digital and the dramatic disruption that we're seeing within the financial services sector, that creates real investment opportunities, right, for people to develop platforms across banking and credit products and investing products that are easily accessible on someone's device. And that creates private capital opportunity for investors across a number of different areas. And you've seen capital flowing, particularly in the startup realm around some of these, but also some later stage companies. And then the last point is, it's not just about access to products. It's also, how does digital and some kind of new and innovative ways of approaching things like credit scoring create opportunities for new products and services that didn't previously exist? And so how do we use this opportunity to develop offerings that are better suited for people with some of the income and wealth, starting constraints that the Black population has?
Are there examples of progress that we're making in this area?
I think there are. I think you're seeing more and more digital banks going after this underbanked or unbanked segment of the population. And if done well, the operating model allows you to have a fee structure that works better for this group because you don't have all of the fixed overhead costs and all the ongoing costs. I think that's one area. I think you've also seen, on the investing side, some apps come into the arena that offer simple investing. I'm not talking about complex things. That's a story for a whole nother day, because I think there are a lot of things that are also going on that are not appropriate. And so we're always mindful that, particularly when you're talking about financial services, that there's this delicate balance between predatory and constructive, if you will. But you've seen some stock investing and other apps that lower the barriers, whether it be you can buy one share and it doesn't cost that much to transact it, or partial shares of things. So I think that there's some innovation going on there. And then on the mortgage side, you've actually seen some innovative things from what I'll call non-incumbents, but even some of the incumbents are now playing around with ideas like lower down payments required and trying to get to this idea of, how do I tailor the product so it's fit for purpose? And I think you'll continue to see investment opportunities in and around that realm, whether it be mortgage products or even developing innovative ways to better assess credit. And if you can do that, and if you can price credit more appropriately, well, that's a business opportunity. And I think people recognize that, and you're starting to see capital flow.
The more success that you see in certain areas, certain products, it sort of then engenders more and more investment. I wanted to switch to the health equity topic. Again, I'm looking at the report, looking at figures, and we see a figure which is that roughly 3 million more Black Americans would be alive today if we were to close the disparities in healthcare between Black and white Americans. What are some of the reasons why these gaps exist? And then we can talk a little bit more about what the opportunities are to help close them.
I think almost every discussion about economic mobility and disparities should start with health. If you don't have health at the foundation, then you can't really participate in the economy in a meaningful way. There's lots of systemic reasons for why we see some of the outcomes that we see in terms of, disparate outcomes for certain populations. Maybe I'll just give a few thoughts on some of the challenges that surfaced in a lot of the work that we look at. The first will sound familiar. It's around access. And just like you have financial service or banking deserts, you've got healthcare deserts. And so just not being proximate to care is a challenge. People are living busy, busy lives, right? I think sometimes we conflate income with how hard people are working, and that's a conflation. I mean, you have people who are working 2, 3, and 4 jobs. So if access to care is not proximate in the context of them working many jobs and taking care of their family, then it is a real challenge. The second one is a spillover from the labor market challenges that many Black Americans have, whether it be the sectors that they're employed in and the types of jobs and what that means in a market where much of the insurance is a function of your job. That's the model that is largely in place. Well, certainly then if Black Americans are not participating the same way that other groups are in the workforce and in jobs that actually confer these benefits, then they're going to be underinsured. And that has huge implications, again, for the type of care that you get. And it's a double whammy because the cost of healthcare at the point when the need becomes acute, because you don't have the access to preventative care and things like that because you're not insured, it's higher. And so if you combine the lack of access with the insurance coverage issues, and then you overlay what we know shows up as bias. I mean, you've seen some of the recent stories that have come out around the mortality rates of Black women who are pregnant compared to other segments of the population, even when you adjust for education level, and it's staggering. And so take those things all together, that presents a real challenge, but it also presents a real opportunity.
I think there was something in the report as well that talked about this notion of bias and how healthcare providers were prescribing pain medication differently based on their own racial bias. So one question then about how investors can help, because you talk about terms like bias and trust.
The investor community alone won't solve this one, but that's the spirit of this whole discussion, is that it's going to take the private sector, private capital, social sector, public sector coming together. I do think there are a few opportunities here. One of the big social determinants of health outcomes way upstream is food and nutrition. And when people think about health, they don't always go there, but this is a place that we should start. And we know that you're significantly more likely to live in a food desert. That is a USDA designated census tract that does not have what is deemed to be adequate access to fresh food. We know that you're significantly more likely to live in one of those areas if you are Black. So how do we think about investing in these communities, in the kind of food supply chain, if you will, to bring healthier and better alternatives to these communities? And by the way, we spent a bunch of time surveying thousands of Black consumers, and their preferences for healthy, organic actually show up as stronger preferences than other communities, just on average. And so the demand is there. So how do we find ways to invest in businesses and business models that can bring that kind of healthy, nutritious food to these communities? So I think it starts there. That's one idea. I think the second is, as we think about our healthcare system broadly, how are we actually ensuring that when you do things like develop molecules and drugs, or when you're training physicians and caregivers, how do we make sure that we are injecting this idea of diversity of patients all throughout that journey? And I think that that actually does represent an opportunity for investors who say, what are the business models and training programs and things that we can overlay inside of the system to help accomplish that? Or even more extreme, if you think about life sciences companies that develop molecules and drugs, you know, one opportunity that we've talked about, you know, are there certain drugs and conditions that are more prevalent in certain populations, like more prevalent in Black populations? That's an opportunity to go nurture some drug or molecule that might be underinvested in if you took a more kind of generic or broader lens. How are we finding these niche opportunities to capitalize things that will disproportionately help certain communities that have maybe been undersupported in the past? So I think that's the second thing that I would say. And the third thing is we start to merge the digital concept with the health and to get to digital health. And that helps to bridge some of the access gaps that we've been discussing. And how are we investing in digital capabilities to get to people in a different way to help bridge some of those legacy issues? By the way, at the same time investing, we do need more brick and mortar in these communities from a health provider perspective. And you've seen some models pop up, some of these smaller format, full integrated internal medicine or specialist health options. And they're starting to show up more and more, particularly in urban markets. And that's an investment opportunity. And you've seen some of them be incredibly successful.
Shelley, you're doing my work for me by sort of leading us into this next section on the digital divide. One of the areas where we see a significant lack of access is in the area of high-speed fixed broadband, right? Looking at one of the statistics from the report, approximately 40% of Black American households, as opposed to 28% of white American households, don't have high-speed fixed broadband. What's preventing Black Americans from gaining this access?
I think about broadband infrastructure in general as really an enabler to address a lot of the other challenges. And I think there's been a sharp focus on this recently. I mean, the administration in Washington has talked a lot about this issue. You have a number of noted philanthropists who have identified this as a core issue and a passion of theirs to address it. And at the core, there are a few challenges. And it differs by the type of geography, right? One is just the physical build out, right? The physical infrastructure itself. That is a challenge. And you've got to put real capital in the ground if you're going to unlock it for folks. And so that's one of the things that with some of the recent bills that have been passed, there's capital that's showing up. And so how do we make sure that that gets to the places where it's needed most? So there's just an infrastructure build out point, which I think a lot of folks are focused on, and we've just got to do it. The second thing is, once that infrastructure is in place, are the services affordable? Can folks actually pay for, consume those services in a way that is not overly burdensome relative to just, because many of the folks that we're talking about in this discussion are rent burdened. They're burdened with the basic necessities of living. It's an opportunity, but it's another cost bucket. And so how are we thinking about the affordability piece of getting broadband? And then the third piece is, once you've got it, then what are the devices that you have to consume whatever you're trying to do, whether it be not just financial services and healthcare, but also educational opportunities? And so do you have a device, a tablet, a computer that really allows you to engage beyond just your iPhone? And by the way, phones are great, but that form factor is not necessarily always conducive to all of the great use cases that we have to leverage digital as a real enabler for education, for health, for financial services. And so we've also got to address that devices issue that sometimes gets lost in this discussion.
You know what's interesting, Shelley? This report sort of sets out a roadmap for investors and says, here are the 8 sort of highest potential areas. All of these are interrelated, as we've just discussed, right? If you can close the digital divide, you can improve financial inclusion, or you can include more people, you can improve K through 12 outcomes. How can investors prioritize, right? We've given them the roadmap. How should investors think about these 8 areas?
We don't have all the answers, and by no means is the research piece meant to be an exhaustive guide. It's meant to be a starting point, if you will, for where we've identified existing sustainable business models and married that to where we've identified interventions that we know will improve outcomes for people, right? So those are the areas we identified. As investors start to think about how do we operationalize that, what are the issues and areas that you're most passionate about driving different outcomes? And then how does that lead you down the road to say, hey, I'm going to focus on the digital divide, or I'm going to focus on affordable housing, or I'm going to focus on banking. So I think it really is trying to marry that view with your core competencies and your professional networks, or even maybe where you think your limited partners, the folks that are providing the capital to you, where they may have interests or where they may want to see you drop. Like, part of this is also to skate to where the puck is going. And so what our aspiration is in putting this out is that we will learn from the field. We hope that there'll be 5, 10, 15 more business models that emerge in each of these 8 areas that are sustainable and that do good along the way. And that's really that's really the hope.
Shelley, this has been a really great discussion, and we've actually only just touched the surface. So let me remind listeners that they can visit us on McKinsey.com to get the full report A Guide to Impact Investing in Black Mobility. Shelley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Roberta, thank you very much for having me.
Next up, lots of AI projects get stuck in a lab. Asaf Sombek is the CEO and co-founder of Aguazio. He joins us to discuss how to dislodge those innovative projects and move them into the real world.
Asaf, welcome to the podcast. It's great to meet you.
Thank you, Roberta. Happy to be here.
So we're just on the other side of Mobile World Congress, right? This huge annual event focused on connectivity technologies and providers and platforms. I know you attended. I actually heard that your presentation went very well. What were your biggest takeaways from the event?
So very, very interesting this time around, because I've been to many MWCs before. And this time, I mean, there was not too much of hype or people just talking about 5G. People were really there to see how they improve their business top line, improve their costs, things like that, that, you know, back to normal business. You know, people need to be profitable.
Speaking of hype, actually, a lot of the hype nowadays is around generative AI. And I'm curious, how does the work of applied AI and MLOps intersect with the work of generative AI?
Sure. So definitely generative AI caught the attention of many conversations. But once again, yes, with all the hype around ChatGPT and the related technologies, people were looking for practical implications on the business. And whether it's to understand where they can apply the technology, and we had very interesting conversations around that, where you can actually obviously improve your call centers when it comes to the large telcos, or on the campaign side where you have, you know, generative AI developing the campaigns or the texts that are specific and personalized for their customers. I mean, huge potential, but people want to understand better how to go about it and what would be the infrastructure in place to actually make it practical. Because at the end of the day, there's a huge gap between the work that has been done with AI in the lab and the current value that it brings to the enterprise as a whole, because this is kind of a big gap that exists today in the market.
Yeah, I know. There is McKinsey research that shows that organizations worldwide have invested almost $500 billion in applied AI, but only 10% of AI projects actually emerge from the lab.
Yes. Yeah, so just as an anecdote, well, one of the clients that I met used a phrase that I love that represents this inefficiency in the market. And she said she has a pilot sickness because I've done so many pilots with AI and, you know, wonderful pilots. But what about results to the business? So that's exactly the problem we're trying to fix.
What role does ML ops play specifically in addressing this notion of pilot fatigue?
Pilot fatigue is the problem. And it starts with the fact that we see many silos today. You have a silo of data scientists that are just doing research. And then the next silo, data engineers that are taking the result of that and trying to recreate it, sometimes even in a different programming language. We see data scientists working in Python, and then data engineers working in Java, and thing gets lost in translation. And it has to actually take a completely different approach that we call it taking a production-first approach, mm-hmm. where already in the lab, you're thinking forward on how that will play out in production. MLOps is about the process of starting in the lab and making sure that whatever was developed in the lab can actually scale when it comes to the daily use of the application in production, to the ability to monitor the predictions, that if some patterns are changing in the way, in the data itself, if the demography of a particular use case has changed as opposed to general software, models are things that needs to be constantly retrained, and something, and this is MLOps, needs to identify the need for retraining these models and apply that while you have like the entire, you know, pipeline of applications running at scale in production. Think about it as a machine learning factory as opposed as an artisan, where, you know, if you build a nice chair in your garage, it's nice, but if you need to build 1,000 of these, you need to have like a factory. And that's exactly what MLOps is all about. It's to create that factory within the enterprise to address multiple applications that needs to use machine learning and the entire process of governing those models and applications, governing and being able to identify when those needs to be retrained.
What are some of the obstacles organizations face when they're trying to roll out and scale up AI experiments?
AI is still all about software, and it has to be integrated with the general practices of software within enterprises. And that's exactly one of the obstacles that we see today, where data science is completely separated from the general lifecycle of software. And sometimes their work is only kind of thrown over the fence to people that need to actually translate it to the general software. Machine learning, and that doesn't work well.
Are there examples of companies that are starting to get this right? Or are there particular industries where we're seeing applied AI succeed more or less than in other sectors?
So obviously the tech giants have been leading that. I call actually enterprise AI today as a luxury of the tech giants, because they understood this gap. They invested heavily with hundreds of people in R&D teams that actually built their entire infrastructure to address these problems. But most enterprises cannot afford to do that. And this is why this, as an evolution of a technology in the sector, and MLOps is all about machine learning operations. It's all about productizing machine learning in the organization. And this is a category that has been evolving over the past few years. And you have products and platforms and services around this technology.
What are the ethical considerations that companies need to think about when using applied AI? Are there resources, a sort of AI bill of rights or something out there for organizations to incorporate into all of their experiments with AI?
So it's a wonderful question, because in fact we don't need to come up with it. As usual, when it comes to regulation, it starts in Europe, and there is a AI regulation that is being formalized. There's already a draft for the regulation around it. And my recommendation to many enterprises is just be prepared for that. You need to have actually the infrastructure in place. Where people sometimes start the AI journey, they only think about developing models in the lab and just plugging them somewhere in their infrastructure. It's way, way beyond that. And this is why we're here for.
It feels like we're running short on tech talent everywhere. Is that the case with this particular category of technology as well?
It's a great point. What we see today is that machine learning engineers and data scientists are spending too much time on infrastructure. Once you brought in an MLOps platform, those people can actually focus on the business problem, on developing the actual application instead of dealing with the pipelining and the infrastructure around it. So that's part of the problem, that people hire those really expensive talents or hard to find talents. And eventually they're spending only 15% of their time on the actual machine learning and data science work. And the rest of the time is around the infrastructure around it. This is one of the key problems in the space. And it creates frustration. People that were hired to actually bring value to the business eventually are spending too much time on infrastructure, and they should be focused on solving business problems rather than infra problem.
Just thinking more broadly, what excites you most about the future of AI?
The whole holistic approach where every transformation that is happening now is including AI in its core, and the ability to deliver solutions by vertical markets. And that's the time we can actually help those companies fix that situation and leverage AI and bring the potential of AI to reality.
Asaf, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Roberta.
Thanks so much for listening to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Find us on McKinsey.com. We'll have a transcript of this episode up shortly.
And check out the McKinsey Insights app, where you can find this podcast and other helpful content updated daily.
And if you would, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.